Testing, testing.
It's great to be here and to see, it's hard to see the audience, but to see so many people here. We thank you so much for supporting KSFR and independent media, which is one of the things we'll talk about tonight, the importance of media in our world. David Iglesias, I wanted to ask you, first of all, to what extent is U.S. Attorney a political appointment and a non-political appointment? As you point out in your book, many presidents take out all the sitting U.S. attorneys and put in new ones of their own party, and you're one of that batch.
Right. We are political appointees. We're appointed to four-year terms, but once we're in office, like federal judges, we're expected to stay out of politics. In fact, Ashcroft told me and every incoming U.S. attorney in the summer of 2001, politics stay outside the door. And we took that advice very much to heart. So we come in through the political process. I mean, I ran for office 10 years ago, but once in office, evidence and the law, that's it.
So how do you decide what cases to take on? And of course, this is an issue that became very important in the firings of you and the other U.S. attorneys.
It's up to the prosecutor to decide based on the input that he gets or she gets from the assistants who are career people. These are people that serve in many cases for 20 or 30 years. And based on their experience, they make recommendations. It's up to the U.S. attorney to decide, is this the kind of case that we want to take? In a district like New Mexico, that is a very, very busy district, we really go for the bigger cases, and we work closely with the state DAs, the state prosecutors, and then they get to work on other cases that may overlap. But it's a judgment call. I mean, there's no quick book recipe to figure out which cases we should take.
So tell us the story, because I don't think you told about it in your speech, of the phone calls you got from the New Mexico congressional delegation.
The infamous phone calls. And I've been meaning to ask Joe if he and Heather are related in any way. But I think probably not. This, in a very strange way, the book kind of pivots on three phone calls. The book opens up with a phone call that I got on December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day. Ironically, I was coming back from some Reserve Navy duty when I got the phone call from Mike Battle, the director of the Executive Office of U.S. Attorneys in Washington.
Now, this is 2006.
This is 2006, telling me it was time to pack my bags and, you know, look for another job. So I thought, wow, you know, Merry Christmas to you too, Mike. But actually, he's a friend, and I figured he was just the messenger. But the real phone calls, the ones that really kind of set the stage, were in October. One was from Heather Wilson, soon to be the former congresswoman. of the first district. And wanting to know about sealed indictments. I'd just shown up in Washington for a conference, and you know, she was snooping around. She told me she'd heard on the campaign trail about alleged sealed indictments, and she wanted me to talk about it. Well, if any of you have ever worked for Los Alamos or Sandia, this would be similar to you working on a classified project, and a member of Congress calls up and says, hey, tell me about that project Looking Glass. You're going to say, I can't talk about that. It's very similar to that. She wanted to find out about prohibited information that I couldn't share with her without losing my job. Now, it turns out I lost my job anyway. And she was not very happy with the answer. About 2 weeks later, in late October, I get a second call from Senator Pete Domenici. Now, you have to understand, and my book goes into this, he'd been my mentor. When I ran for office, he helped me raise money. He gave me a staffer to help out. I mean, I looked up to him, but he was a lot more pointed. His conversation didn't even have any chit-chat like mine with Heather. And he said, look, you know, I want to find out about these alleged corruption matters, cases I've been reading about in the media, are they going to get filed before November? And I thought, look, I'm not a poli-sci major, but I know what happens in November. And remember, for those of you from New Mexico, Heather Wilson was behind in the polls in mid-October when she called. She was desperate for any bit of information she could have used against her opponent, Patsy Madrid. And I'm convinced she picked up the phone and said, Pete, I talked to Iglesias, he wouldn't say anything. What can he do? And I'm sure Pete says, well, you know, hey, he owes his job to me, and I'll squeeze the information out of him. So I just told him about as much as I could without getting myself in trouble, and I just said, well, I didn't think so. And then he said, I'm very sorry to hear that, and he hung up on me. You know, as parents, you know, we always teach our kids, you don't hang up on people. And the senator found out the hard way bad things happen when you hang up on people. So he hung up on me, and I my wife Cindy was standing 5 feet away. I was at home. It was a weekend. And I'd never received any phone call from any member of Congress at home about anything until that one phone call. And that set the chain reaction into motion.
So
can I just say, for the record, Heather Wilson and I are not related. And it's been a long campaign, but we finally have got her out of Congress in a few months. She was sat on the House Intelligence Committee and did nothing when a CIA officer's, covert officer's identity was betrayed by her own government. She was also an Air Force Academy graduate and stood with Tom DeLay rather than with our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines in the debate in the run-up to the war. And all I can say is good riddance.
So where those phone calls are concerned, what specifically were they looking for, and what was the political motivation for it?
They were looking for privileged, confidential information about the Bernalillo County Courthouse case involving former State Senator Manny Aragon, who was indicted 3 weeks after I left. And the political corruption investigations and prosecutions are very, very dangerous for any prosecutor, because you'll always be accused of engaging in a political witch hunt or a political prosecution, regardless of the evidence. So that's what they were snooping around about, and I didn't give them what they wanted. I didn't rush the indictment. I very much felt like when the senator called me, he wanted it filed right away, so that would aid Heather. Because here, if you can't connect those dots, what she would have done with, had I given her the information, she would have used that as an attack piece against Patsy, saying Patsy hasn't done anything in 8 years, no corruption investigations. The feds are going to embark on another corruption case. Because remember the Vigil matter and Michael Montoya? Well, we had prosecuted those cases. So she would have used that as another talking point. And, you know, U.S. attorneys aren't talking points. We do serious things. We put people behind bars. And, you know, what she asked for was completely beyond the pale. And I'm glad she finally paid a consequence, because I'm not sure the House Ethics Committee is going to end up doing anything.
What was the common thread between you and the other fired U.S. attorneys, and what was the process of piecing this together that the seven of you went through?
Most of us were engaged in high-level political corruption investigations. Paul Charlton was investigating Rick Renzi, conservative Republican member of Congress, and his press officer called Charlton's press officer and said, is my boss being investigated? Can't comment on that. That's like calling a CIA operative and say, tell me what's in your dossier. We can't talk about it. Carol Lam had just convicted Randy Duke Cunningham, conservative Republican member of Congress, San Diego. And she was, and this is the bizarro world part of this. She was just investigating Dusty Fago, who used to work at the same agency as Valerie here. He was a number three guy, a political appointee, a Republican. And within 24 hours of Carol emailing Maine Justice in Washington and saying, I'm going to execute the search warrant, Kyle Sampson, the chief of staff to Gonzalez, says, we have a problem with Carol Lam. Exactly. And the problem was she was being honest and was doing her job, and she was taken out. John McKay was criticized roundly by the right wing of the party in Washington State for not getting involved in a gubernatorial recount. If you remember, three recounts, the first two went to the Republican, the last went to the Democrat. She won by 140-some-odd votes, I want to say. And they were furious with McKay for not indicting anybody. And I asked John about it. It's in the book. And he said, I didn't have the evidence. Because you remember, when you accuse somebody of a crime, You need this pesky little thing called evidence. And you have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a really high standard. So, corruption, voter fraud, Todd Graves, the U.S. attorney from Kansas City, Missouri, he refused to indict matters into alleged voter fraud. And that's why the Republicans were mad at me initially, is remember back in 04, New Mexicans, there was all this stuff about voter fraud? Well, I investigated it. And it wasn't just me. It was the FBI local office. It was the Maine Justice. It was the state police. It was a county clerk. And the same problem. We couldn't prove any case, so I'm not going to authorize a bogus case. And they just could never understand why I wouldn't file a politically based prosecution. Todd Graves had the same thing happen to him. So those are the common threats. Now, with Dan Bogdan, I have no idea why he was let go. I think probably because Kyle Samson, and I say this in the book, this is speculation on my part, okay? Samson wanted the U.S. attorney job in Utah, didn't get it, so the next best thing was Las Vegas. I think it was that simple.
So if you look at the big picture, the people who were fired either weren't protecting Republicans or weren't going after Democrats or weren't prosecuting voter issues that would help Republicans.
That's my take, and that's what I essentially state in my book.
So the firings didn't take into account that U.S. attorneys were what you called the legal world's equivalent of gladiators. They didn't stop to think that they're dealing with prosecutors. If you fire seven prosecutors, they're not just going to sort of slip quietly into the night. So
okay.
when you look back on it, to what extent do you feel that our system of checks and balances worked and didn't work as your system, as the whole situation played out on the national stage?
I'll answer that, but I want to go back to my wife's favorite movie, Gladiator. You've all seen it with Russell Crowe, Maximus. They cut seven Maximuses loose and then wondered why we went back in the Coliseum and started killing him. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
To what extent did the system of checks and balances work and not work?
It worked in a delayed fashion. It didn't work right away. You know, this is unprecedented, and no one at Maine Justice, even people that have been there 30 and 40 years have told me they've never seen anything like this. So if anybody tells you, oh, political appointees, bunch of crybabies, you know, say no, this has never happened. The checks and balances came in with a Senate and House controlled by the Democrats. Remember, we believe in checks and balances in this country. Exercise oversight for the first time in 6 years. Had this happened a year or two before, the scandal would have never hit, because my party would not have exercised oversight. So I want to thank you Democrats for supporting your folks.
You're welcome.
You talked a moment ago in your talk about executive privilege. What is it? Where are the actual rules written down about it? How is it interpreted?
Executive privilege is something that even President Washington wrestled with. He was requested to provide some treaty information by the House of Representatives. He talked to his legal counsel who said, if you look at the Constitution, it says that the Senate has treaty-making powers along with you. So he gave the information to the Senate, not the House, claiming privilege. And he didn't use that exact word, but you can go back that far. Those of you that are old enough to remember the Hiss-Chambers matter back in the Truman administration, Truman ordered his officials to not testify about that matter, claimed on executive privilege. But what really broke it loose, and having a court recognize it at the Supreme Court level, was a Nixon case. When Leon Jaworski, learned about these covert tapes that Nixon had made, I'm sure we remember that, and the president said, I don't have to produce that. It's privileged communications amongst my advisors and me. Well, the Supreme Court disagreed, and this is kind of where we're at, because what the president is saying now is that Bolton and Myers and Rove don't have to testify, even though he's admitted he didn't receive any information about them, about us. So it's extended to advice amongst them. And the Nixon case doesn't stand for that.
You wrote in your book the deepest implications of the disaster at Maine Justice are not of partisan politics, nor are they of transient liberal or conservative issues. Rather, at their molecular core, they are issues of illegality and unconstitutionality. So, you're a prosecutor. Whom would you prosecute, and for what illegal and unconstitutional acts?
And does it start with a K? And can we frog march him in handcuffs?
You know, I didn't know Joe had said the frog march comment until just recently. It really conjures up a pretty interesting image of Rove hopping in front of cameras. For a scholarly discussion, read John McKay's. You can get this on the internet. John McKay, the former attorney from Seattle, wrote a piece in the Seattle Law Review called "Trainwreck at Maine Justice." And what John writes, and I agree with this, is once the Inspector General's report is completed, a special prosecutor be appointed. Somebody with tremendous respect, somebody who is not perceived as partisan, and have him or her investigate and then, if necessary, indict. But, I mean, I still see Rove's fingerprints all over this. Gonzalez may have, I think, in my view, perjured himself in front of the House and Senate when he testified. McNulty may have also. So those are possible charges. But again, it's got to be done by an independent counsel.
What do you see as the role of the next administration and Congress in, well, first of all, bringing people to justice and also undoing the damage that's been done in all three branches of government?
Well, they've got to clean up the House. There's been some progress at Maine Justice. I mean, let's be honest. There are only a handful of departments where I think everybody in this room would agree politics should never play a part. Department of Defense, Department of State, Department of Justice.
CIA.
And the independent agency of CIA. I mean, you know, you don't want to have the spying, the surveillance apparatus of this country compromised like it was in Valerie's case. So there's a lot of house cleaning to do, and I'm glad there's been some progress, but the progress won't be complete until there's a completely new administration.
Can I just broaden that a little bit? In my view, and I've articulated this to every campaign that has talked to me, and most of them have, except St. John McCain's, that the Constitution demands that we investigate this administration for possible crimes against the Constitution. And it would be a terrible mistake after they go out of office, not to have full investigations into their activities and a whole host of issues related to justice and related to national security, and let the chips fall where they may. Rule of law and the Constitution of our great country require that.
This is a question for all three of you. I mean, I'm really interested in the picture that is painted in David Iglesias' book, which I hope every single one of you will buy on your way out, and all proceeds go to KSFR. But it's a picture of an administration that is doing things like these firings and many other things for political motivations, but it's not the political motivation of furthering a party agenda like national security or certain moral issues or whatever. The agenda seems to be power for its own sake, the permanent Republican hegemony. And there are cases like Valerie Plame, who's here on stage with us, and many other cases like the firings of the U.S. attorneys, where the actions actually go against the professed goals of the party, like national security. And I was wondering if each of you could talk about in ways in which this administration's actions has actually undermined the party's own political agendas.
Well, I think I may have actually said this in the Lenzik last time I was here. I think that this is a band of radicals who have taken over the Republican Party and are exploiting the brand of the Republican Party for their own radical ends, which are power for the sake of power, power to reward your enemies and punish your friends, and the hell with everything else. Because if, in fact, you're a true Republican, how can you support this administration? If you're a true Republican, you believe in such concepts as fiscal responsibility. and this administration has driven us trillions of dollars into debt. If you're a true Republican, you believe in such things as limited size of the federal government. And you need to look only at the national security proliferation through Homeland Security and Directorate of National Intelligence, et cetera, to see the extent to which they have consolidated power in Washington. And if you're a true Republican, you believe that there really ought to be an upper limit to how much time the federal government spends peeking in your bedroom window. How can you then support an administration that politicizes the most human, the most personal of human tragedies and Terri Schiavo, not to mention everything else that they do with warrantless wiretapping, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that these guys, frankly, operate so far outside the parameters of acceptable American political behavior that, as Richard Clark said just the other night, they should not be permitted back into polite society. Other than that, I hold very few strong views.
What deeply troubles me, and I will stick to my knitting on this question, and by that I mean I will speak to the politicization of our intelligence community. Everyone wants to believe, every American, no matter what your political stripe is, you want to believe that whatever intelligence lands on the president's desk is devoid of ideological taint or political bias. It should just be just the facts, right? That's what you want to believe. But we have seen, particularly over these 8 years, an acceleration of politics injected into it. You see it in so many different ways. Right now you have about 60, I just finished a book about this from Tim Sherrock, it was excellent, about 60 or 70% of our intelligence functions are outsourced. It's like Blackwater, they're contractors. And this, exactly. I mean, conversation for another time, but that is as a result of, you know, favors going, you know, the sort of the revolving door. And let me tell you, what the politicization of intelligence does, it destroys morale, it undermines the product. And in the contractor's case, when you can imagine what that does, if you have 60% of your intelligence product being brought in by contractors, then the actual entity, you know, the institutional knowledge is fading away to nothing. You look across at the heads of the various intelligence entities, many of them are in uniform. Right. For instance, General Michael Hayden at the CIA. I don't have a problem with uniforms per se. I'm the daughter of an Air Force colonel. But when that is your only perspective and that's the only sort of viewpoint that you were getting, I like the saying that, you know, when the only tool in your toolbox is a hammer, every problem starts to look like a nail. So that's a problem, and then that is directly result. And, of course, you have, as you spoke about, Congress' complete lack of oversight. They have completely abdicated their responsibilities. So I feel that I'm deeply troubled by this. I know my former colleagues are as well. And I hope that the next administration that comes in puts this right.
I was wondering, Joe Wilson, if you could talk more about the power for its own sake, modus operandi, and how that plays out on the international stage.
Well, I think clearly these guys have sacrificed some of our broader national security interests in the interests of having power, maintaining power, and continuing power. At the end of the day, if you take a look at this war in Iraq, and you go back and you look at what President Bush said when he was governor, when he said, a war president is a great president, and if there's an opportunity, I will seize it. And that's in his biography that was never written, but the guy who did the biography has talked about that. The opportunity presented itself, and these guys saw it as a way of, one, being a great president, and two, implementing Karl Rove's vision of a permanent Republican majority. A quick, easy war like Grenada, and suddenly they get reelected. It didn't turn out that way. They thought, as Rupert Murdoch said, they'd end up with $20 a barrel oil. It's now 140 or something like that. They also thought that they might be able to actually control the rate of development in India and China by controlling the spigots. King Abdullah, when he came to power in Saudi Arabia, the first trip he made was not to the United States, but it was to Beijing. And for every contract they signed with the United States, they signed 17 with the Chinese now. It didn't work out real well for them. The political and moral authority and international leadership capacity of this great country of ours has been absolutely destroyed. But they were able to ride it to re-election in 2004. So, you know, to a certain extent, and they, you know, the argument was you don't change commander-in-chiefs in the middle of a stream. So hopefully we will have learned. But my view of this is that they have mastered the propaganda machine. And clearly, as you saw, if you saw the New York Times article about the retired generals that they used to propagandize Americans, including Paul Vallely, who one time accused me of having said to his wife in a green room that my wife worked for the CIA, which wasn't true. But that's the sort of disinformation that they were laying on the American people. So hopefully now, over the last several years, the people like Valerie and myself and David Iglesias and Richard Clark and a few others who have stood up and said enough's enough will be able to roll this back. But it has been very clear that they have taken national security and used it as a tool for the perpetuation of their place in power.
One of the things that I really loved reading in your book was about programs that are invisible to activities that are invisible to people who aren't doing them. For example, part of your family heritage is Kuna Indian. You grew up in Panama. You spoke Spanish, English, and Kuna language. And with that background, you were able to, in New Mexico, work with tribal people in New Mexico, Indian people, with an understanding that your predecessors hadn't brought to the job. That's lost. That's a great loss. There are so many losses like that in the programs with the other attorneys who were fired as well. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about those types of things.
Well, it really was a dream job. It would have come to an end. I mean, we don't get permanent appointments like judges do. But, I mean, one of the reasons I love New Mexico is because of the three primary cultures are cultures I relate to. My mom's Anglo, my father's Kuna, but he's bilingual. My mom's bilingual, Spanish speakers. I relate to every of the three major cultures in this great state. I think folks in the future will do a fine job, but I'm not sure they'll really understand what sovereignty is all about. I mean, my uncle in Panama in the 1930s worked on sovereignty issues that ensured a line of sovereign power that the tribe would have. If you don't have that as a background, sovereignty is something you read about in Indian Law 101 in law school. But, I mean, that's in my family. So, I mean, those are issues that I really understood. But, you know, all is not lost. I mean, you know, we're a resilient country. This is a great state. People are moving here. You know, I'm an optimist. I mean, this class is not nearly empty. Okay? It'll be refilled.
Ask and you shall receive.
That's it. And you know, and that's a promise of America. And my book goes into my dad. You know, half of us in this room can trace at least one ancestor to Ellis Island. I used to speak at naturalization ceremonies in federal court all the time. And that's one of the interesting facts, you know, that I found. And my dad actually spent 2 weeks in Ellis Island. The lady that was supposed to pick him up got the date wrong. So he was stuck there for a couple of weeks. So, you know, the American dream, some people will say it's frayed, it's not there anymore. I respectfully disagree. I mean, we're going through a tough time now, but, you know, my parents went through the Depression. They had to worry about the Nazis and about the Cold War, and, you know, better days will eventually come.
So I thought we could talk for a few minutes about the media. We're here with KSFR and very proud to be working in independent media because independent media are really the way that people find out what's going on without corporate media bias. But we're in a very strange situation right now where Scott McClellan, who's written a new book, which is called What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's culture of deception. He's being attacked in the media while Karl Rove is being rewarded by being a pundit. Is this fixable?
Well, over the last week or so, I've had a number of people tell me that David Iglesias was on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, and I thought to myself, who would have thought that... So we've come a long way, baby. I've said this repeatedly, that that the idea that the Wall Street Journal and Fox News would put this lying traitor Karl Rove on their payroll is absolutely beyond me. There used to be a time in this country where you would shun traitors, and now they're rewarded in the right-wing media, which tells you a lot about this particular brand of right-wing media. And I was in an exchange of emails with the Washington Post reporter just a couple of days ago, because he was whining that I asked a question in an interview, where was he when it counted in the run-up to the war? I think the mainstream media has utterly failed in their responsibilities to the public. There is a... Dan Rather gave a great speech at a conference, I think, in Washington over the weekend. I'm sure you can find it on YouTube.
It was in Minnesota.
Minnesota, wherever it was. It was a great speech on the failure of mainstream media. The good news, I think, is that in America, when you're not happy with the service you're getting, competition arises. And you've seen that through the independent media, which I think I don't know what your figures look like, but they can't be going down because there's nothing else to... Nothing we're seeing on the networks or even on cable news. And the blogosphere has grown up and provided a lot of independent analysis. I read every day from a dozen news sources. And I only glance at the Times and the Post just so I can criticize them. And I read from the newspapers all over the world. And frankly, I'm much happier not having to read David Broder or George Will or David Brooks or Bill Kristol, the two neoconservatives they put on the editorial page. There was a time in the media where you actually had to earn your chops before they would give you a column. Now you just have to be an ideologue. And I don't think we're served that well by a return in the mainstream media to really what is essentially yellow journalism.
With regard to Scott McClellan's book, I have a couple observations. First of all, I had the luxury of time and distance, and I have to say, when this all sort of blew up, I thought, "Thank goodness it's Scott and not me." So I had a little bit of remove to observe, and one thing was apparent was that all the White House supporters and apologists and so forth did not at any point go after the substance of his revelations or allegations. They just sought to discredit him. And, you know, I'm in 24 hours into the beginning of the news cycle thinking, how long will it take before we hear rehab or drugs or little girls or little boys or, you know, take your pick? And that did, in fact, come out in the fullness of time of, you know, this is just not the Scott that I knew. But then within the next 24-hour news cycle, the mainstream media were questioning themselves in sort of response to some of his allegations. They would show clips at Scott at the podium at the White House, and they'd be throwing questions up. And some people were saying, well, the media was taking umbrage that they were being criticized by Scott and other commentators, that they hadn't asked the right questions or enough of the questions. And all you see is they're in the White House press room. Well, you know, they think that because they said, is that true about what the president said about WMD, Scott, that's really investigative reporting. That's getting out there. You know, that you could tell that various well-known commentators were offended that they had been criticized, that they did not somehow miss the good question or didn't. And what Joe and I have said all along, pertaining to our particular story of the leak and so forth, is that They just sort of took what was spoon-fed to them. We believe that, and that's applicable both to the war, to our case, to many other things. I'm making sweeping generalizations, but that's what they are. That their reluctance to find the analysis, to find another story, to find someone else who maybe counters what the administration says.
High-paid stenographers. I asked this Washington Post journalist who was bitching at me for having used his name, Tom Ricks. I said, Tom, send me some of the articles that you wrote in the run-up to the war where you actually weighed the facts, where you tested the evidence, where you got a source that wasn't official, where Scott Ritter would be a good one to have checked with, Brent Scowcroft, Joe Wilson, somebody who had actually been on the ground in Baghdad. Send me this. Let me know what you actually did when it counted. And I haven't heard back from him yet. High-paid stenographers in the rush to war.
Yeah. And I just want to add about the media. If you look at my acknowledgments in my book, I acknowledge lots of media. But I'll say one thing. When you talk to the mainstream media, you have about 5 or 6 minutes to get your message across. And sometimes really complicated issues, intelligence, for example, criminal justice, for another example, it's hard to boil those down in little sound bites. It was nice to be on the Diane Rehm show for an hour and actually get to speak in complete sentences. C-SPAN, Washington Journal, same thing. I was on for half an hour, took calls from citizens from across the country. It's just nice to have the ability to sit down and actually have a conversation and not a compressed micro interview. I'd like to acknowledge TPM Muckraker. Those of you, I can see there are some fans out there. TPM stands for Talking Points Memo. So if you've never been on the website, just go to Google or your favorite search engine, type in Talking Points Memo. And you can point it. It's wonderful. It has links to original documents, to testimony on Capitol Hill, and lots of scandals from throughout the country are listed on TPM Muckraker. And I specifically thank them because they're the first ones that really kind of put the pieces of the puzzle together in the media, and they've been really staunch backers of the fired U.S. attorneys.
Scott McClellan, in his new book, talks about this prevailing way of life in Washington, which he calls, I mean, he's not the first person who's called it this, but politics as war, where you not only oppose the other party, but you demonize them, destroy them, and call them evil. So that's a way of life where it's pretty hard to govern in a bipartisan and sort of friendly way across the aisle. What can you envision a way to heal that and to have a country where the two sides of the aisle are actually governing together in some way?
Well, I'll start off with this. I'm actually still of the view shared by the Dixie Chicks. I'm not ready to make nice yet. Why would I reach across the aisle to a bunch of thugs who have criminalized governance in my country? So I think, and I actually think, that, again, I think these people are radicals who have taken over the brand of one of the two major political parties in the country. And the only way that the Republicans are ever going to have the fight, they need to have the fight over who owns them. Is it the Republicans I talked about earlier, fiscal conservatives, fiscally responsible, limited federal government, and sort of civil libertarians? Or is it the collection of neoconservatives and theoconservatives? And they need to have that fight. They're not going to have that fight until they're defeated. So I sort of like to think of myself as Dr. Wilson, who wants to help them heal themselves by driving them out of office in a way that allows them to have that debate they need to have, in my judgment, over who they are.
If I may offer just a different viewpoint. Compromise is considered a bad word in Washington. It is a sign of weakness should you appear to compromise. Now, anyone who has ever worked on any volunteer board or you know, school board or done anything in committee work or at whatever level, you know that that is the only way sometimes that you will move forward. And you're right. The culture in now has become so polarized. I think the entire country has been on this track. You can probably pinpoint it from the 2000 election. We are friendly with Tom Foley, former Speaker of the House, and a great raconteur, lovely gentleman, and he would regale us with stories of how sort of it used to be in Washington, where you could fight sort of all day across the aisle, and then, you know, at the end of the day, you'd go out and have a beer together because you realize that ultimately you had to work something out and you might as well be as friendly as you could be. I'm not sure that we'll ever get back to those days, but we do have to get back to an idea where in Washington, compromise is considered a way ahead rather than losing.
Let me just add, Tom Foley also said one night we were together that in 1994 when Newt Gingrich and the Republican Revolution took over the House of Representatives, that Gingrich came to office as the Speaker of the House and he instructed his colleagues and their staffs, do not talk across the aisle. Do not talk to a Democrat for 90 days. We're going to set a new tone here. And that's the tone that has been set. I don't think it's been in the interest of our country. Valerie's absolutely right. Honest debate leads to the sort of zigzagging back and forth that we do and generally sort of moving our society forward. But we need to have sort of rules of engagement that that allow us now to find the way forward, common ground. If you took a look just last week or just this week, the Republicans blocked the debate on global warming. So how are you going to do that? Well, put them in their place. Beat their asses.
I just want to add that if Karl Rove had finished college and read the good book, he would have found a verse that said, if you live by the sword, you'll die by the sword. And unfortunately, you know, they've sown destruction, and they're reaping that right now. There does need to be a new tone. And what I've heard from career friends at Maine Justice is what I'm hearing here. It's never been this bad. I hope it bottoms out because compromise is absolutely necessary, and I'm hopeful. For those of you that have kids in college, you know, tell them please finish because you read a lot of good books and you get a lot of good ideas. The effect that Rove would actually think anything is permanent in this life, especially politics, good grief. I mean, what books was he reading? It just doesn't work that way. That's all.
Can I just add, actually, we actually have Republican friends. And I come from a Republican family.
There's one on the stage, I believe.
Pardon me? Yes, absolutely, in addition to David. My great-uncle was a Republican governor of California. Arlen Specter, if you read The New Mexican, you would have known that he spent the weekend with us here in Santa Fe. Chuck Hagel's a good friend of mine. Brent Scowcroft. And, in fact, my ambassadorship, which Carl Rove and Ken Melman and Ed Gillespie would like to have airbrushed out of my curriculum vitae, came in a Republican administration. George Herbert Walker Bush named me ambassador. And I was in charge of the embassy in Baghdad during the first Gulf War, which I think will go down in history. I wrote about this in my book as a classic case in how you manage international crisis. So my beef is not against Republicans per se. I don't believe either party has a monopoly when it comes to wisdom in public policy making. My beef is against this brand that first emerged with Newt Gingrich in 1994, and has certainly flowered in the fullness of time with the arrival of people like Karl Rove in Washington and the arrival of the George W. Bush administration.
In your book, David Iglesias, you spoke about the period where you were getting ready to run for state attorney general in New Mexico, and you were an independent, and you were talking about which party really that you were going to affiliate with, and on the one hand, the Republicanism appealed to you because of the moral Christian thread, but on the other hand, didn't appeal to you because you saw the ravages of free market capitalism, which they embraced, on the people. Where do you stand on that now? I mean, would you cross the aisle?
Well, I have lots of friends. Yeah, I just need to tell you, I mean, I was an independent for 12 years from the time I graduated from Santa Fe High School in 1976 until I was about 30 when Cindy and I got married in D.C. and came back here in the late 80s. That's when I figured, well, the core idea is I identify more with Republicans than Democrats, but I never bought into this, you know, it's my way or the highway kind of mentality. And I was used to trying cases with people in military court that we absolutely went hammer and tongs in court, but afterward we could go out and play basketball. And unfortunately, politics isn't that way now, but I think it has been in the past. Will I change party affiliation? Probably not. I'm hoping that we have new leadership, and I think after you all probably clean our clocks in November, there'll be new leadership both at the state and national level. You know, we really need two parties in this country that are robust. I mean, look what happened.
At the very least.
Yeah, and maybe even more. Yeah. Because look what happened when my party was in power for 6 years, and the notions of checks and balances and oversight didn't apply. Well, I mean, look at the fruit that's borne. Virtually every member of Congress that's either been indicted or is currently serving time are members of my party. And that happens when you're unchecked, when there's no one on the other side saying, wait a minute, you can't do that. Or let's talk about this. Let's work this issue. So, you know, I'm hopeful for a new sheriff in town. Now, I do need to say this. If the Democrats sweep and are in charge of all major branches of government, I hope they don't make the same mistakes as the Republicans did.
What's next for you? You're in private practice now?
Right. Yeah, I've got four daughters. I love them. Three are in high school. And I need to earn some money for a while and get them through college and probably pay for some weddings in the near future. I've loved public service. I've served at the state, local, and federal level. I have no intention to run for office. I have a lot of respect for people that can do it and maintain their integrity. I don't have that same respect for people who don't maintain their integrity in the political process. I think there are lots of temptations. If you read my interview in the Reporter, I actually dredge out an old Greek myth of Odysseus and the sirens. And if you remember that, you know, he made all his crew members put wax in their ears so they couldn't hear this intoxicating call of the sirens. And Odysseus didn't put wax in his ears, and it drove him crazy. I think that's a pretty apt metaphor for what happens to a lot of people in politics who don't put the wax in their ears. And that wax is the rule of law in the U.S. in the Constitution.